go. 3, 2, 1. Hey guys, this is Dean with the Two Party Podcast. I'm on here with Lucas Cantor. Did I pronounce that properly?
You did.
I did. I've been slaying names lately. So Lewis is a talented composer, musician. Or Lucas, I'm sorry.
There we go. You got it right the first time.
Yeah, I messed it up already. See, I've been on this roll with messing up names lately. But Lucas has an extensive background and resume in music, and just amazing. Before the show, before me and him linked up here, I was literally on here just kind of jamming out some of this stuff on his website. Very interesting. I encourage you guys to go check it out. But let's let Lucas tell you guys a little bit about himself, where he's from, and how he got into music. Go ahead, Lucas.
All right. Well, I'm Lucas Cantor. Lewis is also fine. It's close enough. And I'm a composer and a guitar player here in Los Angeles, California, which I guess you can't tell I'm in Los Angeles, but I am. Mm-hmm. And I write music for film and television, and lately more for concert stages, and which is a whole different thing and a lot of fun. And I do a lot of guitar playing and mandolin, and I can't really turn the camera here, but I have mandolins and guitars and mandolas and all sorts of different string instruments that I play, which it sounds impressive. Like, I think I play like 20 instruments, but you know, they're kind of all the same. They're just, you know, with frets and strings.
Yeah.
You know, slightly different techniques to each, but
of course.
So I play stuff on film and TV, and I write stuff for concert stages, and I'm working on a book at the moment, and yeah, I love to read. I'll just come right out and tell your audience something about me that almost nobody knows. I have an obsession with Mesopotamian history. I read a lot of books about Mesopotamian history, and I'm really into it. It has nothing to do with music, nothing to do with anything, but there you go. There's a fact about me.
That's awesome. That's awesome, because each guest usually comes on and either I get it out of them through us talking, or they just, like you just did, they just kind of divulge, like, yeah, I'm really interested in this. I think yesterday, who was it that I had on? I don't even have my show notes with me from yesterday, but he was on here yesterday. He's like, I'm into Stoicism. And I'm like, that's cool. Right. You know, hey, out of the blue, random. And he's like, yeah, I just think, you know, I've just been looking at it, studying it, you know, just kind of as a culture thing. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. You know, like, hey, teach their own. But Mesopotamian history, it's hard even for me to spit it out. What made you just start getting into that? I mean, what lures you to that?
Yeah, I guess
history as a whole is cool.
Yeah. So Assyriology is, I think, the more normal term for it.
Right.
Or the more correct term for it. I think Mesopotamian history is the more correct term, but academics use Assyriology. Actually, it was podcasts that got me into it. So the first podcast I got really, really into, a composer friend of mine turned me onto, and it was Mike Duncan's History of Rome.
Okay.
Which any history people will know. You know, he basically goes through, you know, from Roman prehistory all the way through the capital moving to Byzantium. And so I just got really into that. And then I read a book about Carthage, which is the city that the Romans famously went to war with in the Punic Wars. And I thought, you know, this book was about, where did the Carthaginians come from and why were they called Punics? It's because they were Phoenicians. So they originally came from over near where Israel is, the city of Tyre. And then I thought, well, so there was a whole civilization over there before there was a Roman civilization. What was that civilization like? And, you know, you keep going backwards and backwards, and it turns out the first written records we have are from Mesopotamia about 2500 BC.
Yeah.
And so that's really where history starts. And we have a lot of recorded history from that era. So it's interesting to read about, to me.
It really is. And it's funny that we even start off that way. I mean, and I've read a lot about history, and a lot of it just doesn't, you know, I if you bring it up and talk about it, I know it, I know the names, I know all that. I just never really, it just doesn't come to the forefront of my mind. But what's interesting to me about history is, if you look at today, we look at what countries we have left, you know, in the world. But nobody really goes back into history to look at where civilizations really came from. There's a lot of civilizations and tribes that are no longer existent. And people don't really realize, like, we think of just America and China and Europe and Africa. We don't ever really think about, like, the Assyrians, you know, and stuff like that. We don't think of, like, these nations that were huge nations that started our civilization off. And at war or whatever, and just were dissipated or destroyed. It's really interesting to look at history. I forget what book it was I used to read a lot. I actually read it like 3 or 4 times because it just was so detailed on information on history and different civilizations. It is amazing. It is really cool to dig into that stuff.
Yeah, it's I mean, the civilizations of Sumer and Akkad, the first really proper empires that we have documentations for, are not only, you know, they're not only forgotten to most people who don't study history, they were literally forgotten to all of history, to all of the world, for thousands of years, mm-hmm. until they were rediscovered in the late 19th century, middle 19th century. And there were, excuse me, there were British Assyriologists discovered a library of, in the city of Nineveh, of a king named Ashurbanipal, who was obsessed with collecting texts. And luckily, the Sumerians wrote all of their information in stone tablets, mm-hmm. sorry, in clay tablets, which is great because it's preserved and papyrus yeah. doesn't last that long. And Ashurbanipal's library was burned to the ground by his enemies, which is terrible and traumatic for the people who were living in Nineveh at the time, but it's great for people who are looking at clay tablets 2000 years ago because they all got baked and preserved. So, so that's where a lot of our information comes from. And most listeners have probably heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh, mm-hmm. And that's where that was discovered. You know, and wow. it was translated in the, I want to say the 1840s by a British, an amateur British Assyriologist, a guy who just used to hang out at the museum and had a knack for translating texts.
Yeah.
And he translated it. And when he translated the first line of the Epic of Gilgamesh, he jumped around the room and because he realized that he was the first person in 2,500 years to read that text.
Yeah. I mean, how amazing. I mean, mm-hmm. You're probably just like me. Like I hear on the news or like we still get the National Geographics. I give them to my son and stuff after I read them. And we get all kinds of like just really cool information stuff that we give out to my son and stuff, science stuff. But you're probably just like me. Like when the news announces like there's a new discovery in Egypt or they just dug up a new tomb, like you're probably like just like me, like, yay, it's a new discovery. Because I find that stuff exciting. I think it's kind of cool. I mean, as much as, you know, historically people are like, don't dig up the dead, leave them alone, you know, but some of that stuff really does help give us insight into, you know, where we all came from, you know, how things changed over there and how we got to where we are in America. I mean, it's great history to know, but I get super excited about the stuff.
Yeah. I feel like 1,000 years is a reasonable statute of limitations on grave robbing. You know, right. I think if you've been dead for 1,000 years, like you might have, you might be more valuable with us looking up, looking into what's going on in there.
Yeah.
And I personally, I mean, you know, I guess this might come down to people's individual religions, but me personally, when I'm dead, whatever you want to do with my body and my personal effects is fine.
The cool part is, I mean, they're preserving these things, you know, it's not like they're just going in and desecrating graves and, you know, they're actually going in and preserving, putting them in museums and, you know, research. And so to me, like, it's not that bit of going over the line with it when you're actually just using it for research or learning from it. And it's all being, you know, taken care of.
I think about the Iceman sometimes. You remember this was, you know, about 20 years ago, they discovered this guy who was frozen in a glacier and was thought to have lived about 9,000 years ago. So, you know, I think that's right. And he was pretty much preserved. I mean, you know, he was on ice. And can you imagine that guy? I mean, I don't know what his life was like. You know, they can sort of figure out what he was eating and all that kind of stuff. But here he, like, can you imagine being him, or imagine even today, the humans of 9,000 years from now talking about you and talking about your, and trying to reconstruct how our civilization was based on what you have on you and what you have recently eaten.
It's like, you almost want to make sure you die with something cool. Like you don't want to croak and be in an ice age and be frozen if you don't have something cool on you, you know, like.
I think I should swallow this jump drive just for future historians,
all history. Right? Yeah. It's like, I want to die with something cool on me. So I got to be prepared when I, you know, could croak at any minute. If I'm not mistaken, they got DNA off him. Like he was so well preserved. Oh, yeah. They were able to actually get DNA totally off the tissue from him because he was so well preserved.
Yeah, that's I think that's true. I mean, there was definitely soft tissue still on him, which is
totally amazing. Yeah, totally amazing. Let's dig in a little bit here. Tell us a little bit about some of the scores you've done, some of the stuff you've worked on. One of the things that caught my attention, we were talking about technology earlier as we were kind of going through getting set up, is you actually finished, and I'm looking right now. Hold on one second. Let me get to it. I'm going to find it. You actually finished a composition with AI. Am I correct?
You are correct. It was Schubert's Unfinished Symphony is what you're looking
for. That's what I'm looking for. Yeah, I'm digging. I'm digging. Tell us a little bit about that, how that came about, like what got you into that, like this is what I need to do, and how you were able to implement technology with that.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think the when people think about artists and composers, they think that, you know, that we're these sort of monastic creatives who come up with ideas and then just execute them, and you know, the sort of money and the finances just come out of nowhere, or that we're independently wealthy. And you know, really nothing could be further than the truth for almost every composer you've ever heard of. So the Schubert's Unfinished Symphony was not something that I had been wanting to do my entire life. It was something that a client wanted to do. And I mean, musically and creatively, it's right up my alley, which is why they thought of me. And it is amazing. But the impetus from it actually came from the technology side. The computer scientist who built the AI, Mick Grierson, is a friend of mine and someone who I've just known for years. And he thought that this would be a good project for me. And the technology company Huawei approached him about doing it with their technology. Yeah. And they wanted it to be a big marketing moment for them. So it was interesting because sometimes when you do those things, the client really is more concerned with how they look than how the event is. But Huawei was not that way. They gave me full creative control. License.
Yeah.
They said, whatever you need, we're going to do. And, you know, we're just here to support you. We want you to do this with our stuff. We don't want, you know, we'll make it, you know, we'll put our logo on it, but we want you to really do it.
That's and, amazing.
Yeah, it was, you know, you can't ask for a better creative partner than that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So, they asked me to do it. We didn't have a ton of time. We had a concert scheduled in London, and we managed to, by the skin of our teeth, get it all done. And the results, I think, are amazing. I don't know if it sounds like Schubert. I think parts of it do and parts of it don't. Mm-hmm. But I really, other composers and academics have finished Schubert's Unfinished Symphony based on lifetimes of research and study into Schubert's music and his life and his history. And they've done a nice job. Brian Newbold comes to mind, who's a composer in the UK who has two movements of the two remaining movements of Schubert's symphony that he's performed. And they're great. And I was trying to do a different thing. I just kind of wanted to see what AI came up with.
Yeah.
And I tried to stitch it together in a way that made sense to me. And that I thought was as true to Schubert as it could be given what the AI had suggested.
Right.
So.
And how does that process work? Like, you know, let's say you know what instruments there are. And so you kind of know what he's using for this composition. And then is that kind of like an input into the system and the AI kind of changes it? Or does it reflects on kind of the dynamic of the mood of how the tone of the composition is going at that point where it's unfinished? Or how did it work?
Well, if you think about any symphonic work, I'm trying to think of, you know, something that people know, like the score to Star Wars, or maybe the Ride of the Valkyries, which is maybe for people my age more familiar as a killed a wabbit.
Right.
Yeah. So when you think about those pieces, you think about a melody, and you just think about, you know, the Darth Vader theme or you know, that music at the beginning of Star Wars. But what's going on there musically is there's a whole orchestra and they're all doing something.
Right.
And they're all doing something very specific to support that melody. So we had the AI in the Schubert project. We had it come up with the melodies, but I had to figure out what the rest of the orchestra was going to do in order to support that. And in some cases, I came up with the melodies to get us from one place to another. But
yeah,
for the most part, it was AI generating monophonic melodies and me stitching them together, orchestrating them, and elaborating on them.
That's super cool. A lot of it. We're in a day and age where technology is really awesome. Some people fear it. Some people can't handle it. They don't know how to function, you know, use it and don't want to learn. It's just a learning curve. They're not, you know, a lot of older folks, especially. But
no one who's listening to a podcast.
Right. Exactly.
This is so technophobic.
Yeah. But it's just one of those things that's like, it's so amazing where we've come. you know, and really in such a short time. I mean, I remember like even mid to late 90s, even still having dial up in some places. You know, you go to a friend's house to use the internet, and it was like, you know, you're getting, if somebody called in the house, you lost your signal. You know, it was like, I just remember dial up being a crazy thing growing up. And but technology's come so far. I mean, the fact that we can just have a phone in our hand and literally pull any information we need to pull is just amazing. But where we can use it in music is even cooler. You know, I tinker around with music. I am by no means, I mean, I'm still trying to learn that guitar hanging on my wall behind me. I am by no means a musician. My grandfather was. Music was kind of in our family. But creatively, like, I love trying to learn. I can make some noise, which is basically what it all is. But I you know, I have my mixer here. When I'm in the studio sometimes and I'm just kind of bored, I'll try to put stuff together on DAWs and use different software. I'm just not that good electronically. I'm old school, like analog. Like I just want to plug something in, keyboard, whatever it is, just plug it in and play it. I'm not really good at mixing stuff with the software. How much of your work, nowadays, I know most people are using, you know, software. It's just easier with the technology to mix and record. How much do you, when you compose, how much do you organically try to just use instruments as opposed to some of the electronic?
Well, I think, you know, since we're doing video, I'll just give you a tour.
Yeah, that's fine.
Hold on, let me turn a light here.
Perfect.
So I'm going to answer this question. Also, I'm gonna have to go kind of off the mic, so everyone will just you'll just accept the conceit of what's about to happen. So there's two sides to my studio. The first one, and I guess we'll do video, and I'll like describe it for people who aren't watching. So you can see behind me, there's some books.
Yep.
And those are books that I love and that I'm reading for various things, but they're also diffusion. Mm-hmm. So they're sonic diffusion. So behind me, this is the analog side of the studio, right?
There you go.
This is a bunch of guitars, bunch of instruments.
Beautiful collection. Beautiful collection.
You know, it's so that's that. But then this is kind of the meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
Over here.
There it is.
And so I said I was going to describe and I didn't. So on the analog side, it's just a bunch of guitars. It's a bunch of guitars, instruments, banjos, so on and so forth in a nice little wooden closet. And then when I swing around here, you can see there's a DAW with monitors and a pile of books on there. And, you know, there's four monitors. Two of them are for video and two of them are for the DAW. And that's what I'm recording into right now. So my world is really both analog and digital and technological and musical. And they both kind of go hand in hand. For me, the ability to use a DAW is just it's a necessity of my job. So
I think I feel the same way as you. To integrate both is great.
I feel like I feel the same way as you. I didn't come up like with a passion for using technology to make music. It just, you know, it's like if you're a writer, you really can't get away with just writing on like yellow notepads and submitting that anymore.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you have to submit your stuff digitally. And that's kind of how it is with music, at least film music, is that, you know, it ultimately gets even symphonic music at some point gets written into a music notation program.
Yeah.
You know, so even the most old school composers who still write stuff by hand, at the end of the day, that goes to a copyist. It gets input into Sibelius and it's not their handwritten score that goes on the stage.
Yeah. It's amazing how that integrates.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. One of the things I like to say is, or that I like to remind people of is that all music is digital.
Yeah. 100% you know,
when you're listening to, I mean, right now, and 100% of the people listening to this podcast are listening to a conversation that has been captured entirely digitally.
Yep.
And when you're listening to music that was made in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, that all of that music was recorded digitally at the very least. And even if it wasn't recorded digitally, even if you're listening to like Bill Monroe recordings or Chris Thiele recordings, who is, you know, a contemporary artist who records the tape. He records the tape, but you're listening to it on your phone.
Right.
You know, exactly. Like what you're listening to is
it's being processed MP3. Digitally. Yeah, for sure. You know, it's things have changed so much from the cassette tape.
sitting home and
making recordings on my cassette tape.
There is a company in LA, and I don't remember the name of the studio, but there is a studio that records straight to a
straight to record.
There is a studio straight to a lathe. Like they literally you record it and it's making the record as you record it.
That's amazing.
I've kind of always wanted to do that.
It's kind of interesting, like just to do it and say you have it. You know, this is what I got. I had this made. That's kind of cool. What other, you know, I'm looking, you've done a lot of some animation scores. I mean, you've done a lot, you know, and I'm sure just looking at your page is not even close to touching on some of the stuff you've already done. What would you say, honestly, is like the genre or say the vibe of music that you really dig? Like, what is your overall? I mean, I know as a musician and composer, it's hard to pin it down because you just love it all. But if you were to sit back and turn some music on for yourself, what would it be?
Oh, well, it depends on the day. One of the
kind of a mood thing.
Yeah, it's and I love bluegrass. I love jazz. I love jam band music, like like Fish and the Grateful Dead. It's funny because I that stuff is actually more nostalgic to me than informative. But there was a period where I loved it. I love, you know, Jimi Hendrix and like Pink Floyd, the sort of psychedelic rock era. I love that. I love the music of the 1920s. I have some plectrum banjos here that are from that era that a lot of people don't know that the four string banjo was like the electric guitar of the 1920s.
Of that day.
And it was the instrument that all the cool people played and people, I mean, there was a guy named Eddie Peabody who would fill stadiums playing, you know, imagine a guy playing a banjo in a Candy Striper outfit. That was the style that he played in.
And that was the thing.
It was, I mean, he was like Beyonce. I mean, it was the thing. Yeah.
That's cool.
And so I'm really into that era of music. One of the things I did recently, and this is on my Spotify artist page. I just went through and made a playlist of all my friends' music.
Yeah.
And so I think it's this featured playlist on my Spotify artist page now. It's called Best of Friends. And it's just all of my friends in LA and New York and, you know, all over the world, really. A lot of them are musicians and a lot of them have put out albums, especially during COVID, and all of these albums are fantastic.
Nice.
And so it's this playlist, it said, my rule was that I it had to be something that I didn't work on because, you know, these are all people that I work with, but I just wanted to find, you know, what was the stuff that they were doing. And the stylistically it's extremely diverse and it's all just like, you know, really good quality music. So I guess to answer your question, I'm sort of on a, it's not so much a style of music or a type of music. I listen for what the artistry is. And in bluegrass, it's playing fast and making it sound effortless. And in pop music, it's creating these incredibly dense sound designy, like super produced, extremely specific soundscapes and making them groove and making them sound effortless.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for me, I think all music to me, and I music has gotten me through some of the ups and downs in my life. And I love music. My wife's always like, turn that down, you know, like we'll be in the car and I'll jam something. She's like, what is this you're listening to? For me, it's mood and emotion. It literally, if I can hop in my truck and go do an estimate on a project or something, I'll jump in my truck, hit the highway. One day I could be listening to hip hop and the next day I'm listening to metal and the next day I'm listening to blues and the next day, it's mood and emotion for me. It's where am I at in that moment? And what do I want to hear? What sounds good in my ears and what kind of the mood I'm in for the day, you know, it just kind of gets me driven. But music is just the one thing I've always loved and cared about music is that it is truly the one thing that unites people. Because really at the end of the day, no matter who you are, even people that say like, well, I don't listen to music. Well, they watch TV. And when they watch TV, they're hearing music and they're hearing soundtracks.
They listen to my music if they don't know it, but.
Correct. Yeah. And there's things that they pick up, you know, there's little tunes and stuff. Like even to me, it's just amazing because music really is something that it's one of the few things in the world that unites under all landscapes. I mean, you can bring somebody who's an absolute hip hop fan to a concert of rock and they will groove. They'll get into it eventually, you know, and vice versa. I mean, it's one of those things where you can almost, you know, bring the peace just with music. It's amazing.
You know, maybe some anthropologists are listening and they'll disagree with me, but I do believe that
the war drums.
I was going to say that I was going to say that I believe that music is produced and consumed by every culture on the planet. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we have found an exception, even like in the uncontacted jungle tribes of Brazil. I think that they produce some kind of music. So yeah, I think it is a human, it is part of the human brain and part of the human experience. the oldest instrument that we're aware of is 40,000 years old. It's from Germany. It's a flute. And so that means that humans were spending time and resources when we were hunter-gatherers, we're spending time and resources creating music. You know, right. And this was when every calorie that we pulled in had to go to feeding us, you know?
Yeah.
And somewhere there's a
guy on the sideline playing the flute.
Yeah. We were a band of like, you know, chronically calorically deficient humans, but someone thought, you know, well, this is actually worth our time and effort. And this is 20 or 30,000 years before we started farming or living in cities. We were playing music.
And it's amazing, you know, I mean, obviously music plays on our senses, you know, obviously if you have no hearing, you can maybe feel the vibration. I mean, that they've showed a lot of deaf people can actually feel that vibration and it actually interacts with their brain as well.
Well, Evelyn Glennie is, you know, have you heard
of her? Yes, I have.
Or I should say Dame Evelyn Glennie, who is, because she has been knighted, but yeah, she is a hearing impaired, deaf percussionist and she's, she's one of the best in the world.
Yeah.
Sorry to be specific. She's one of the best percussionists in the world. She's not one of the best deaf percussionists in the world.
Right.
She's a world-class musician with a, you know, London Symphonic Orchestra and soloist everywhere else. And she doesn't hear the way we hear.
Yeah. And that's what amazes me is, you know, it's just using our senses, you know, I mean, there's obviously different trades do different things, different people in different fields, but music, you know, it even reaches that to that level, you know, you don't even have hearing and you can literally sense the vibration and the feeling. To me, that's amazing. It's just anything that unites to me is, I guess I'm just in a day and age. Maybe I've become the old hippie of me has come back to the new hippie of me, but I'm at a point where I'm in a journey in my life where I like helping people. I like encouraging, you know, people to do better, to succeed. I like lifting people up versus, you know, watching them fail. You know, a lot of people can in our society these days like to sit back and they'll watch someone suffering, but they're not going to step up. And I'm at a point in life where, you know, I really like to help give a platform for people to, you know, be able to help themselves, help others. If I can give advice or lead somebody down a road that'll help to promote their business or whatever, I try to do that, you know, and music is one of those things, again, that just kind of unites. And it's one of those things you can strike a conversation with anybody off songs, you know, like something can come on the radio and you can just start kind of tuning it, singing it in your head. You'll see someone else bobbing their head and you can strike a conversation that way. It's just so interesting how music is so intertwined in our nature.
Yeah, I mentioned Beyonce before, kind of deliberately, because you know there are a lot of people that everybody knows. You know that not a lot, but several people that everybody knows. But there are almost none of them that you can mention and everybody also likes.
Right.
You know, like I don't think any listener, anyone. I mean, you know, I could say Donald Trump. Everybody knows his name. Everybody has an opinion about him.
Right.
But if I say Beyonce, I don't think there's anyone who doesn't like Beyonce. Like they might not. Like buy all of her albums. Yeah. Like, I mean, like I'd go
you
see
know
a show.
Who she is. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's no one has a real problem with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think musicians are able to walk that line in a really interesting way. I mean, even actors sort of have, can be polarizing, but like a great musician and a great entertainer is just, something that the world really values kind of unreservedly.
Yeah. And it amazes me too. And it's exactly like you said, I mean, we could be here in America with a famous artist, Beyonce, and over in China, she's just as famous or actually more famous over there. You know, it's amazing how that works. Like two totally different cultures can absolutely love the music and the tone and the emotion that comes out of that music.
Yeah. Or K-pop is another example of something that's cross-cultural and it's kind of like American style. I mean, I guess it started as American style pop music, but it's definitely its own style.
Twisted.
Now.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's something that American teenagers enjoy, even though it's, you know, like some of it's in Korean.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, you know, actually I don't know enough about K-pop. I'm pretty sure some of it's in Korean.
There's a couple of my son's friends that listen to that and I've heard it and it is in Korean. What they listen to anyhow is Korean. You can't understand a word they're saying, but they're in there just jamming out to it.
Yeah, it's amazing to see that come full circle because for generations it was, you know, sort of American and British music that was exported to the world and people were digging it. And it's nice to see, you know, it's like watching our children come home, you know, it's like watching a different generation.
Yeah.
You know, like we sent Janis Joplin over mm-hmm. to Korea, and then this is how she came back.
Yeah,
you know, this yep. is her grandchildren, her BTS.
Right, that's awesome. Now you mentioned earlier, just touched on it in discussion about COVID and the pandemic and how that's affected musicians. I mean, obviously, everybody in the world's affected for no matter what industry you're in. But tell me the ups and the downs of it, because I'm hearing ups and downs. I know in my industry there's ups and downs, because I own a construction business, and I also do the podcasting, and I also do I do journalism as well. I'm all over the place. I think it's just adult ADD or something, but I'm into all kinds of stuff. But tell me what you think the positives and maybe the negatives of this whole pandemic's been for the music industry.
Well, Dean, let me ask you, as someone who has a construction business with interest rates and home ownership at interest rates at record lows, home ownership at record highs, and Home Depot's being basically sold out of everything, mm-hmm. what is the downside for you? You're making too much money?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You don't know what to do with all the money you're making. Is that the downside?
There's too many people out there that are home too much to where they want to fix everything that they're looking at because they're stuck home. And so yeah. everybody wants to do a project in the middle of a pandemic and while that's great for the industry, it really is. We've kind of stepped back a little bit with our company because I'm kind of like, I don't want to send my guys into somebody's house starting remodels when we know potentially I could be getting my employees sick by sending them in. So we really do look at and scale what we want to get into as a project. We started to scale back a little bit more from residential because obviously you're in homes that you don't know what's going on. And we know with this, with the COVID and everything, that you can't tell who has it. You know, it can be one of those things. You send a guy in to remodel a bathroom, that family's perfectly healthy and fine going in, and midway through someone catches it, then what? So it has been interesting. And like you just said, yes, there's been tons of increase in profits because people are wanting to remodel everything that they have to stay home. They're not at work 9 to 5. Now they're at home seeing every problem with their home and they want it fixed. And it's an interesting dynamic, but at the same time, I as a business owner, I'm 44, I'll be 45 next year. I've owned a ton of businesses. I've been in construction 27 years. I, as a business owner, care enough about my employees and myself that I don't want to put the profit over their health.
Yeah, it's funny because so I don't actually think about that side of it. I started this by making a joke and I didn't actually think about you kind of educated me there,
which was actually a good joke.
Yeah, but no, but you're right that like so what I don't think about is because I'm stuck at home and because my job doesn't involve me dealing with the public, you know, in it used to, but it doesn't anymore. So I don't think about, you know, there's a real and reasonable fear that you'll get infected. I mean, I won't. I'm home.
Yeah.
Sometimes I go to a playground and I go to a supermarket with a mask on.
My biggest thing when I talk about it with people is, it's not my fear of dying of COVID, period. It's just like, even if the COVID never existed and this pandemic never happened, to me, I avoid getting the cold. I avoid getting the flu. I don't want to catch something. That's just been my whole entire life. I don't want to be sick. And that's what I think on a real shallow level of discussion on it, that's it. At the end of the day, it's not about like who's going to catch COVID, who has COVID, how widespread it is. To me, it's about protecting me, my family's health. We don't want to be sick. That's it.
Yeah. And I mean, and you're employing people and you don't want to send them into a dangerous situation. I mean, you know, we're private citizens who run businesses that are not supposed to be dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, so
to be responsible and we have to be accountable for those that work for us.
Yeah, totally. And you know, if I had, I've been able to record a lot during this pandemic because a lot of people have home mm-hmm. studios, but I wouldn't send someone to a recording studio where they might catch COVID just to, you know, get a job done. I totally understand that. But the way that it's affected music is, I mean, I think it's in some ways well documented. It's been horrible and devastating. Uh-huh. And it's gonna, you know, music is not going to be the same. There are some mm-hmm. of those places that you like to go see concerts are going to be condos by the time this is over.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I miss venues. I miss venues because I'm a live music type of guy. I love seeing a good show.
Yeah, but there'll be new ones, you know, like, I mean, mm-hmm. there will be, the scene is definitely going to change though. I mean, in New York, I know, I think the Jazz Standard just closed, which is, you know, a club
that's
where,
insane. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty important club. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it's, It's not quite the Carnegie Hall of jazz, but it's pretty close. It's you know, in the top five jazz clubs probably. And there are a lot of venues like that that just aren't going to be able to stay alive. And that's sad. And one of the positive things that's come out of the pandemic is everybody is doing these remote collaborations. I mean, I've almost done the same amount of work just for a lot less money this year than I did last year. But one of the interesting things is, you know, I mean, you can see here, I'm in my home studio. On the other side of that door is just a, you know, a townhouse and a normal place that people live.
Yep.
And I've had this for a while. This is sort of how I work. And a lot of people work like this, and we go to big recording studios when we need to record an orchestra. But as a result, we've been recording remotely and sending files back and forth to each other for years. I mean, it's in a way we've been preparing for this.
Yeah. Almost ready for it. Yeah.
Yeah. And like one of the things, you know, you've seen on Instagram and so on, people posting videos of them recording remotely, and which is cool. And it seems like a new thing, but it's just us taking videos of something that we have been doing for years.
Just you and your element, really.
And so it's, so that's been interesting, and it's been great for musicians who have invested in a home studio, who had previously invested in a home studio or are able to still maintain some work. Cause there's some things going on there. You know, I've had a few like pretty good, you know, marquee gigs this year, despite everything.
Yep.
But yeah, overall, overall, my business is down 50%.
Right.
I used to have like 1.5 people that I employed pretty regularly. I don't have any right now.
Yeah.
And you know, like for me, a 50% hit is still livable. But it's it's not good.
Yeah. Bills are getting paid, but it's not really helping the upper end. Yeah.
No, it's not. It's not. It's hard. And it's also like coming out of 2019, I think, I mean, for me personally, 2019 was a pretty fantastic year.
Yeah.
And
I think
I was looking at building
year.
On that success. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was hoping to build on that success this year, but, really we're just, you know, we're able to tread water, you know, comfortably, but it's, you know, we're not making any progress, and that's frustrating.
Yeah. And it's hard when you can't make plans. I mean, us as humans, we're just used to making these vacation plans, and next year we're going to go here. And, you know, all those things change because right now we're all in this for the first time. We're experiencing something like this. This is a, you know, it's got it to the point where it's too many unknowns. You can't just plan ahead 3 months and expect to be able to do it, because 3 months from now, there could be another lockdown. It's gotten really, really kind of crazy. I've heard from a lot of musicians that have been on the show lately, a couple that we've just recorded the past week. And they said that the same is exactly what you said, 50% of their business has dropped. They are very thankful and happy that they've built new relationships at this time by doing collaborations with a lot of artists they never thought they'd work with. Even though it's just virtual, they've made a lot of really good relationships. They also, a couple of them mentioned that it had given them more time to be in the studio, which they were always on the road or doing shows locally. So it gave them more time to actually focus on putting stuff down and recording versus actually having to go try to make that $300 gig each night. You know, those guys, you know, like you started out mentioning earlier, is, you know, a lot of people kind of assume musicians just have this lush, lavish lifestyle and they're just loaded with money. You know, I've come in from musical family and stuff. Like, I've watched, you know, you're a $300 gig when you're a starting out musician is amazing. You're like, yay.
That's the rent.
Right. And so it's like one of those things. If you play two or three nights a week for 300, awesome. But there's a lot of musicians that don't, you know, and so I've heard from a lot of them that it's been great to be able to get in the studio, during this time, this downtime for them, but at the same time, they're not making ends meet, you know, and that's a sad part of the industry.
Yeah. I mean, like, $200-$300 gigs a week,
right,
all year is like, you're talking about, that's like $32,000 a year.
Right.
You know? And you're hustling your ass off for that money.
Yeah. You're loading equipment, unloading equipment, setting up, having problems, having to buy new equipment when it breaks. That all comes out of that little budget, and it's not very much to live on.
Yeah. But, it's been, I've been lucky to, like, I haven't really been touched by no one in my family has gotten sick or
that's
passed
good.
Away,
that's good.
Luckily. And that's, you know, so I've kind of got the just sort of like cynical view of the pandemic. Not cynical, but just like, I haven't seen the real human toll personally.
Right. Yeah.
And so for me, it's been like kind of surreal just to, to be like, you know, I mean, I know it's important to stay inside and, you know, I'm doing my part. I'm doing, you know, whatever I can, but you know, we also have two children under two, which is, you know, they don't want to be inside all day.
Yeah.
And it
affects your heart so much when you have kids. when you have kids, you're just like, my son's 12. So luckily, you know, he's at an age where like, he's okay going in his room and reading or watching some TV every once in a while, but he also does jujitsu and luckily he's able to still train. But he's one of those kids, like he doesn't really care. He's like, whatever, I'll do whatever, I'll go along with it. But he's at that age. But when you have younger kids, you know, you want them to go outside and play. You want them to have fun and exercise and be kids. And this whole thing has changed that. That's for sure.
My brother-in-law is a computer programmer and he jokes that he said, oh, stay inside, play video games and only interact with my friends virtually. Been training for this my whole life.
he's got a trophy already set up.
Yeah, he's like, this is what he was doing before anyway.
Yeah, so, yeah. And it's, you know, what's difficult, and it's funny you mentioned that because I was saying probably about 2 months ago, maybe 3 months ago, I was right where you are. I'm like, I don't know anyone personally that's been affected by it. I don't know anyone that's, you know, what is this all about? You know, is it political? What is it? And a good friend of mine ended up in the hospital. He ended up, he's been 10 years now going through chemotherapy for cancer. Had an already compromised immune system. And he ended up catching it. He ended up at the same time going to the hospital. When he went to the hospital, he ended up having a brain aneurysm and a heart attack at the same time. They immediately had to put him into an induced coma, with COVID. And so he ended up on the respirator through the coma and he did make it through. He's back again, but he's unable to walk. Pretty horrific. What the toll it took. I mean, all those things obviously took a toll. But the COVID itself has kind of destroyed his respiratory system worse than anything. And it hasn't really come back. I know several people, including my son's coaches at jujitsu, have had COVID and they've quarantined. they both just basically at this point, they're past it a few weeks and they just still don't have no taste and smell at all. Can't taste anything. We had a friend, a really good friend of ours, whose grandfather actually ended up, he got some pneumonia, pre-pneumonia type lung issues, respiratory, caught COVID. He just passed away.
Yeah. I just want to clarify. I didn't think it was political or like that. It didn't
exist.
I do know several people who have gotten it and recovered. Don't have, in addition to the like professional and psychological inconveniences, I don't also have like grief because one I know has
personally passed away. Yeah.
No one I know has passed away from it, which is,
I'm blessed in that way, and I'm right where you are. You know, it's been a couple months now. And I'm like, wow, it is close to home. And so, you know, being the head of our household, I mean, I literally tell my wife, you know, me and my wife both love to go out and shop. I mean, I think everybody likes to get out of the house and, you know, whether it's go shopping or go to the park or just go walk around somewhere. And so we've limited that. You know, I've told her, I said, it's not that we need to be scared of catching it or be scared of being sick. We don't want to be sick. So if we can just limit our activities to what is necessity, and if we want to go somewhere, we can go to a park. We just kind of steer clear of the big crowds and stuff. You know, I know California is kind of locked down a little different than most states. Like here in Oklahoma, as long as you wear a mask in public, you're okay. You know, and most businesses, that's it.
Yeah. That's how it was in LA, you know, I mean, and I just to, we'll get political for a second, but you know, the rhetoric is that, you know, California is a communist state that is imposing lockdowns, but you know, in Southern California, we have more people in LA County than live in Nevada, more people than live in Oklahoma. Yeah. So, I mean, it's the reality of our situation
area.
Is completely different.
Yes.
You know, and it's, area. You know, the mayor of Los Angeles governs more people than the governors of 26 states.
Yep.
You know, we live in a different world. And so it is, you know, and if we go over our emergency room capacity, and the reason we've gotten into this most recent lockdown is because we had less than 15% headroom in our emergencies. And if we go over that capacity, like thousands of people are going to die. And
they don't have
not just people with COVID, but like, you know, while this is happening, I mean, people also go to the emergency room for other reasons.
Car accidents, other health issues.
If you're driving, you know, because you have to drive somewhere and you get in a car accident, God forbid, and the emergency room is full, you know, even if you have a minor injury, you might die because you can't get treatment. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, and I think for me, I'm not really scared of getting COVID myself. Me and everyone in my family now is sort of robust enough that we would probably be fine.
Yeah.
I'm really scared of giving it to someone else because I wouldn't, if I caught it and I didn't know and I didn't wear a mask and I like gave it to an elderly person at the supermarket, you know, I mean, how am I going to live with that?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I try to be cautious, but
And I think that's the biggest thing for me, honestly, is that, you know, it's not, again, it's not about being, I take good care of myself. I'm pretty healthy. You know, I work out a lot, I exercise, I take a lot of supplements. So I know, like, generally I will probably, if I got it, I will probably cycle it right through. I'll probably be down for a few days or, and that's it. You know, I'm not worried about that end of it, but like you said, I want to protect my family, but at the same time, I never want to have on my conscience that I didn't know I had it. Cause there's a lot of people walking around that don't realize they don't have the symptoms that are, you know, they're just asymptomatic. They don't realize they're walking around with COVID and they just happen to be in a grocery store and let me help this old lady get something off a shelf and hand it to her. And she catches it. It's something as simple as just being nice in your daily walk that you could accidentally give it to somebody.
I know, like just trying to be a good guy and you accidentally give it to someone.
Let me help this old lady across the street. Next thing you know, you didn't know you had it. She caught it. She passes away. And so exactly. It's, I think we all have a responsibility, you know, with the old term, I am my brother's keeper. You know, at the end of the day, I think it's, we all have a responsibility, no matter what side of the aisle or what political affiliation you have. At the end of the day, it's human nature. You know, you have to take care of other people, whether you want to or not. You could be somebody who's absolutely reclusive. You hate people, but it doesn't mean you have the right to take lives. And it doesn't mean you have the right to not protect your neighbor. If that means stay on your property, stay on your property. It's not about taking away rights. I think politically, I think a lot of people get it confused with like, you have to wear a mask. And then the people wearing masks are yelling at the people that don't wear masks. At the end of the day, I think it's just an accountability. I think it's just a responsibility. We don't want people to die, period.
I mean, the mask is pretty simple. Like even
it's not going to kill you, right?
You know, I mean, even if COVID is made up and the mask does nothing, like just in the event that it might be helpful, just, I mean, it's not going to be forever.
Yeah.
You know,
how many people grew up and wanted to be a ninja? How many people grew up and they wanted to be Darth Vader. They wanted to be Boba Fett. Yeah, come on. The mask thing, putting it on for a 10, 15 minute walk through the store. You got to go somewhere, wear it, you know, out in public, going from to your car to whatever. You know, I don't see it as much.
I find it mildly annoying.
Annoying. It's inconvenient. But at the end of the day, like, even now, like, you know, and I got a lot of friends and they won't wear masks. They're just like, whatever, dude, this is my right. And, you know, and Oklahoma is a very, very right state, you know? So, I mean, obviously here it's very, everybody's like guns and God, you know? And at the end of the day, that's great and all. But when I go to the store with my wife and my kid, we go grocery shopping, we wear our mask. And there's a dozen people walking around Walmart or wherever we go shopping. And they all are not wearing, you know, a dozen or more of them not wearing masks. We're wearing ours. And as much as I don't want to wear it and she don't want to wear it, we both disagree about wearing it. We're going to wear one in public because, again, it's not just protecting our health, but it's protecting who we're interacting with. If her mother comes over, who's older, if you know, somebody, a neighbor comes over, who's older. It's exactly like you said earlier. You want to be accountable and responsible and respectful to protect the lives of other people. And that's really wearing that mask. If it's just an inconvenience for 10 to 15 minutes, oh, well,
you know. I mean, it's also like, I don't really understand. I mean, you know, I live in California, but like, you know, I have guns and I don't, you know, I probably have different feelings on God than you do, but like, you know, if you like church, God bless you. Enjoy it.
Yeah.
And
that's it.
I think that a lot of people are, they're just kind of acting like petulant children. Like, they just don't want to do it because someone in the government told them that they should.
It's telling them to do it. And it's an authoritarian issue.
Yeah. And it's not even the worst part is it's not even the government telling them, it's doctors using the authority of the government to get the message out faster. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. I would, it just doesn't seem like a rebellious act to me.
No,
you know, like, I mean, going out and protesting for what you believe in, whether that's whatever that is, I feel that, like, I like respect someone who goes out and stands and says, count me as for this belief, even if I don't agree with the belief, but like, I don't want to wear a mask because I think it's stupid, because I think I'm smarter than a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, just like, it's not like he's asking you to do something, or it's not like the doctors are asking you to do something that are like, live your life normally, just wear a mask in public so you don't get other people sick.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, I sit here and I reflect on, like, the whole 2020, and it's like, you know, the lockdown, or at least the beginning of the nonsense started a little at the tail end of January, February, whenever, beginning of the year. We've gone through an entire year. You know, life is short. We've gone through an entire year and people are still arguing over a mask.
Yeah.
It's like, do you not have a hobby? Do you not have things better to do? Go read a book. go purchase a hot rod to build. Go get a motorcycle and go on a cruise. You know, whatever. But it's like,
don't go on a cruise.
No cruises. I saw it. Yeah. Oh, the funniest part is I saw a friend of mine, not funny really. I kind of felt bad, but he got a good deal on a cruise, and him and his family went on a cruise, and they're posting pictures of them out on this cruise. And I'm going, that's probably one of the ships that was quarantined for 2 weeks. You know, like, you don't want to be on that ship. And he was just like, dude, we got such a great deal on this cruise. And I'm like, well, yeah, but how's that hospital bill going to be later? You know?
Yeah. In the best of times, a cruise is a cesspool of disease.
I was just going to say, in the middle of 2018 or 15 years ago, going on a cruise was always like, it was a 50-50 roll of the dice. It was Russian roulette every time you hopped on that ship.
Yikes. I think, I mean, I guess it's probably more of an issue. It sounds like it's more of an issue in Oklahoma than here. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's just because it's a statewide mandate. It's just, you know, you don't have to wear a mask if you don't want to, but any business can refuse you service if you don't.
Yeah. And it's way here. I mean, in Tulsa, we've got some really high numbers here, and even our outlying cities are this kind of the same way. So they've kind of like, the mayor's kind of put down a little more rules and made it a little more forceful. But at the end of the day, it's exactly what you said. Every business has a sign. And they can tell you, you know, as soon as you come up, there's a sign on the door that says wear a mask. If you come in the business, they'll tell you to put it on or leave. And to me, as a business owner, that's fair and square. If somebody comes in my business, I don't know who they are. They're a stranger. I don't know what their environment they live in is, how clean they are, whatever it may be. I don't want them in my business. You know, I don't want them to present themselves into my business, which then would potentially get me sick, or another customer coming in my business getting sick from them. So it's just fair. If you're a business owner, common sense, have your customers put on a mask. It you know, most people aren't shopping for an hour or two sitting in your store. So if wearing a mask for 10, 15 minutes, that's it. I mean, that's not bad.
Yeah. I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the other side of freedom is, you know, if they have the right to behave how they want to behave, and you have the right to, you know, like, the one of the things I always think about is, you know, free speech is, it doesn't mean speech without consequences. Like, you can come up to me and say whatever you want, and the government is not going to intervene, but I might intervene.
Yeah. I might punch you right in your nose.
I don't have any obligation to allow you to say whatever you want to me.
Right. Exactly.
And I mean, I'm not a violent person, but if, you know, someone comes spewing nonsense at me, like, and in a professional situation, I'm not going to do business with that person.
Right.
And, you know, they have the freedom to say what they want to say, and I have the freedom to react how I want to react.
Yeah. So. And I think that's, you know, that's part of the thing where I think a lot of people are missing is, we do live in such a, you know, you look around the world right now. I do a lot of news breakdowns on my live on Facebook and stuff like that for the program, and just going through headlines, you know, we live in again, the land of the free. We live in a nation where we have free speech. We live in a nation where we can do what we want, own businesses, and do the things we need to do. And then you look at the news headlines, and you've got North Korea is shooting people. You've got, you know, other countries that are just doing things that are like mind-blowing because of speech or because protesting or whatever it may be. And here we live in a country where we have all the freedoms of the world to do basically anything we want within reason. And we're fighting and arguing over it. It's like, yeah, well, you can do anything you want. Why are you sitting here arguing? Go over to North Korea and try to argue and see what happens. It doesn't work that way in other countries. I think sometimes in America, maybe it's the entitlement. Maybe it's we're just so used to the freedoms that a lot of people just forget, like, how blessed we really are to live in a place where we can speak our mind.
It's deeper than that. I think a lot of people forget that this country was founded on a bunch of people who had very little in common other mm-hmm. than geography, deciding that they were going to throw their lot in together. And,
yeah,
you know, it's been these like bloodthirsty arguments
yep.
from day one, mm-hmm. really. And that's part of who we are, that we are able to resolve these conflicts nonviolently in almost every case.
Yeah.
And, yep. and that's fantastic. I mean, you know, when we started, I talked about how I was interested in history, and there are no other nations like this. I mean, this Sargon, mm-hmm. this first emperor, of the first person to rule over an empire that we know of, you know, he was basically an empire at that time was everybody is a slave of the emperor.
Yeah.
That's what the empire is.
And historically, you know? So, most like, nations were yeah. that way.
And the, you know, the Romans were a you know, for all their forward thinking and, you know, good government, you know, they were a pretty homogeneous group of mm-hmm. people. It was essentially a several ruling families controlling most of the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
And in the United States, we're just not like this. And mm-hmm. I mean, say what you will, I'll get political for a second. Say what you will about the Clintons,
right?
You know, and you say anything you want about them, and I'll probably agree with you, but like, they came from nothing and became a ruling family.
Right.
You know, and like maybe they lied, cheat, stole, and murdered their way to the top, but they got yeah. there, you know?
Yeah. yeah.
It's possible. And you could say that about, you know, many of the sort of hallowed names in the Senate. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are not people who have been in generational wealth for
right. Right.
thousands of years. They're people yeah. who maybe their grandfather got
yeah,
rich.
Yeah, maybe one generation may have had some help. Or wealth.
Yeah. I mean, like, even Trump is the stock of immigrants
yeah.
not that long ago. I mean, you know, if you look at the British royal family, the Windsors have been in, you know, they've been royal for 1,000 years or
yeah.
something like that.
Yeah.
But so, you know, we do have, that's part of our DNA. And I think the polarization, I guess, we're sort of dancing around in this country, I think is largely imagined and mm-hmm. almost entirely fueled by the media, because people agreeing is not good television.
No.
And I know this because, you know, not because I'm a genius, but because my father-in-law is like a pretty hardcore Trump supporter.
Right.
And I am a musician who lives in Southern California.
Yeah.
So obviously we don't see eye to eye, and I've never lived more than 20 miles from an ocean.
Right.
And, you know, we obviously don't see eye to eye on this, but when we talk about, you know, issues that are important to us, we are within the realm of compromise on basically
yeah.
everything.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, he thinks X, I think Y, but Z is fine for both of us.
Right.
And we're fine, you know, and that's how the country is at its core. It's just, you know, if we talk to each other,
yeah,
everything's fine. And you know, you can tell this because Congress, despite the, you know, the rhetoric, Congress passes laws basically every day, and they pass mm-hmm. a lot of laws unanimously.
Yeah.
You know, it's the, you don't hear about the, like, no. the Music Modernization
they have
Act.
To have the political theater up front in the media, and in
right.
the background, they're actually doing stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And that's because, you know, I don't know who's listening to your show, but I'm like really easily findable on the internet. You can, I'm
mm-hmm.
Lucas D. Cantor on Instagram, and you can go to my website, lucascantormusic.com, and email me or call me. If you want to talk to me about politics, especially if you like love Trump and think Antifa is ruining the country, like I'll talk to you about it. I'll talk to you about it for as long as you want. Because at the end of the day, we're going to realize that, like, you know, we basically want the same things,
yes.
and everything is fine.
Yeah. And I had, I'm going to look it up right now. I'm going to find these show notes after I drop that. I'm not even going to, yesterday I had a guest on, and it was Dylan Oglein. Mm-hmm. So I had him on yesterday, really great kid. I say kid, he's in his 30s, he's a younger guy. But he brought this exact same point you just made is what he brought up. He said, you know what, at the end of the day, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, as humans, as Americans, we all actually want the same stuff. We don't want homeless people. We want people to have health care. Just a matter of what roads to get there. Everything, no matter what it is, the disagreements, the divisiveness in the media, we all, at the end of the day, we kind of want the same thing. We're all really in agreement. Like you just said, we may not agree on X and Y, and that we're just kind of a little bit displaced, but Z is okay. We can find a compromise. And he made a good point that it's true. Everybody, I don't think there's anyone on the right or the left that wants a big homeless population. You know, we want people to have help. Yeah, I mean, everybody on every side can agree that those people deserve to have some dignity. They deserve to have a house. They deserve, you know, some people live their lives homeless and that they choose to. That you can't get those people in a house if you wanted to, and if you did, they'd trash it. But that's more of a mental health issue. And at the same time, we also don't want people running around sick. We want people that can't have health care to have health care. I think on both sides of the aisle, that would be something we can all agree on. And so I think, like you said, a lot of the political theater you see with Congress in the background, those people, what people don't realize, because the media doesn't really push that, these people, Nancy Pelosi and McConnell and all these people, they go to the same dinners. These people hang out, their families meet, and they go to dinners and dances and all kinds of things together behind the scenes. Congress, those people are all, they become friends behind the scenes. And they may disagree on points, but they know what they know how to separate the professional side and their personal side when they're out doing things. And I think a lot of people in our society forget that. You know, they think it's all Facebook, we got to argue. It's all Instagram, we got to argue. The media is telling me left and right. To me, I've come to a point in my life where it's no longer, to me, the party lines have failed. That's kind of how I look at it. I think both sides have their own issues of failure. And I don't think either one of them is doing good for you and I's family or American people's. When we're still looking at, here we are in 2020, we do still have homeless. We're in 2020, we're still arguing over healthcare. We're in 2020 and we're, you know, here we go through a pandemic and we've got people arguing over taxpayer money and how much the taxpayer people should get back for COVID relief. Why? Why are we going through these issues in 2020 when no matter what side of the aisle you're on, we all need the help when we need the help. And we should be able to trust our government to not argue over handing out relief, but versus say, okay, this is taxpayer money. Let's get the relief out there and all these extra things. And when this side wants this and this side wants that, we can argue those issues later, but let's get the people that are needing cash, let's get it out to them. And that's where I start seeing the party lines, both sides fail. I'm so disappointed in our government this year. It blows my mind. I almost feel like I need to just vote independent from here on out. You know what I mean? Because this year has really shown me that both sides of the aisle don't care about the American people. It's all about the political theater.
Well, I can just offer a solution real quick, which is,
stop watching the news.
No, I mean, well, definitely stop watching the news. So I'm not on Facebook deliberately. Mm-hmm. Because I at some point realized that it basically just pissed me off and didn't, I gained nothing from it.
Nothing.
And so there's that. And I'm on Instagram, but my Instagram is just me playing instruments. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, there's no, my father-in-law says, yeah, I can't be on Instagram because it's too political. And I'm like, I have not had a single political interaction on Instagram ever.
Exactly.
You know, but it's what you search for. Right. But the joke is that, like, you know, Donald Trump and Joe Biden as a citizen of the United States don't affect your lives really at all. And the person who does affect your life, like for me, the person who affects my life the most is probably Eric Garcetti or maybe David Ryu, who's my city councilman.
Right.
And so a city councilman,
community governor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these are like the people, like, and everyone listening to this podcast has a local government. And mm-hmm. I bet that almost none of them know who those people are.
Right.
Because the national news sucks out all the oxygen, but what's happening in the background is, you know, in Los Angeles, for example, the 15-member city council is providing over the second most prosperous city in what would be the fifth most prosperous country in the world if mm-hmm. California was its own country. Yeah. You know, these are people like, I mean, they are presiding over an insane, insane amount of money and an insane amount of people, and they are doing it with almost no oversight whatsoever.
Yep.
And the evidence of this is that in the last 18 months, three of them have been brought up on federal charges and one of them went to jail.
Yeah.
So, but this is not even news to most people.
No, it's not newsworthy. No.
Yeah. I have a, like, and I'm, you know, Eric Garcetti our mayor is a fantastic public speaker. And that's pretty much the end of his skill set, as far as I can tell. And you know, my father-in-law and I, he'll every once in a while say, like, yeah, your boy Garcetti. I was like, you know that your daughter and I like worked for his opponent in the last election, right?
Right.
Like, we didn't, not only did we not vote for him, we like gave we money and time guy. To his opponent. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, and he's like, I mean, the other thing that I find hilarious, or like, I don't even find it hilarious. It's baffling to me is that, you know, they're considering appointing Garcetti to Secretary of Transportation. Apparently mm-hmm. he's the front runner on Biden's list. And so there've been protests outside of his house to block his nomination from Black Lives Matter. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I completely support, I mean, obviously Black Lives Matter. If all lives matter, then also Black Lives Matter. Yes. It's just logic. But yeah, obviously I support their cause 100%, but like, let Garcetti be the Secretary of Transportation. Like, Biden's trying to do us a solid. He's trying to get him Garcetti off of our hands. And
yeah,
I guess
he's
the argument
him out
is
of
like,
here.
Yeah, like, get him out of here. But I guess the argument is, well, we don't want him to, you know, have a platform for higher office. But let me ask you this. When has the who is the current Secretary of Transportation?
Right.
Who was the past? When has the Secretary
Nobody
of Transportation gone on to higher office? The answer is never.
Yeah.
It's not a stepping stone. It's, you know, what it is, it's a stepping stone to Garcetti moving on to what his real like life's goal is becoming a very high paid lobbyist.
And a bigger politician. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But he's not going to have the Secretary of Transportation is not going to put him on the national stage.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned, you know, about your Instagram. That's just all music and stuff. If you go to like, I use Facebook still for the show and for advertising. That's it for promotion stuff. If you go to my personal Facebook page, no joke, all you will find is positive messages or workouts that I do. And then the rest of it, no joke, my friends are just like, what is wrong with you? All music. I post every day thousands of 80s rock and roll. Any music I find on Facebook, I post to my page. So if you go to my personal Facebook page, you'll find zero politics, nothing, not one article. I don't do anything political on my personal page. Why? Because A, it's my personal page. And for B, that's what I'm into. I like good positive messages. I like good music. I'm in political groups. If I want to go have a political conversation and waste some time arguing with somebody, I can go in a Facebook group privately and I can argue away. But at the end of the day, it's not productive. It does nothing, but at the end of the day, it just drains energy. You know, it's just not healthy.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's because you can't have a political discussion, you know, one sentence at a time. I mean, the Constitutional Convention was not a bunch of people trying to land savage burns.
Right.
You know, it was a bunch of really smart
trying to make solutions.
Men trying to come up with solutions. And it took them like weeks to iron out all these finer points, because that's what politics is, you know, coming to a consensus over a period of time in great detail. And so, you know, there is nothing there. Like, I mean, this is why I was so surprised when my father-in-law said that Instagram was political. Cause I'm like, well, is there even, it's just pictures.
I was going to say,
how can you argue
less.
In pictures?
Yeah.
You know, like, so like you post a meme, I post another meme.
Yeah.
You know,
it's probably the least political out of all the platforms, really. I mean,
but I mean, social media, I guess like my opinion on it is simply that social media is a bad venue for politics.
It is.
It's a bad venue for discussion. It's a great venue for promotion.
Yep.
And a great venue for like, for me, I view it as like, you know, you see my Instagram, then maybe you want to go listen to my music on Spotify or whatever, or maybe you want to go see a concert, but I'm not trying to get anything profound across, you know?
Yeah.
That's what podcasts are for. You know, you can have an extended discussion and, you know, elaborate and, you know, actually have a thought and sort of let it air out and find its natural conclusion.
For sure. Tell me a little bit about what you're working on now currently music wise. And tell me, maybe some of these projects are going, or some of the things you've planned for maybe coming into 2021, what you're looking at and working on.
Well, I'm going to be, releasing a track on Spotify about once a week in 2021. I've got a lot of music that I've been working on. And so sometimes it'll be an album and then there'll be nothing for 2 weeks, but you know, it's basically, I'm going to release about 52
slow
pieces
releases and stuff. Cool.
I just on Tuesday released an album called 2020, which is just string music that I wrote. It's like small string orchestra, and it's music that I wrote about 2020. And I'm terrible at promoting it because it's like pretty depressing. And I get that nobody like wants that right now. It's just, it's more of a personal project for me, and that's why it's on there.
Yeah.
And I think that in, you know, maybe next year, when everything's better, if you want to like revisit some of the emotions that we had in 2020,
right,
it'll still be there.
Right. Kind of a lot of low tones and
No, it's more, it's like, it's just very pensive. And like, for me, the thing that has been the most difficult has been like the noise in my own brain.
Yeah. You know? And as a musician, that can help kind of relieve it.
Yeah. And so that's really what that album is. January, first week of January, I'm going to release, first and second week, some like really fun music. I've got an album with a band called Space Hustle that's coming out end of January. And that is super cool music. Cool. And I'll be releasing the Unfinished Symphony in March. So
very cool. Very cool. Well, you know, it's been great having you on here. We could probably go chat forever. I find myself often with guests on, and I'm like, man, I'm loving the conversation. Let's keep rolling. But I know you're probably busy. I know I'm busy. I've got another guest interview coming up shortly. It's been great having you on here. Tell the audience a little bit about where they can find all your information, your music, where you prefer for them to contact you and stuff.
Yeah, Lucas D. Cantor on Instagram. You can find me, you can DM me, whatever you want there. Also Lucas Cantor Music, if you want to send me a longer form thing, the contact us or contact me page is, you know, it goes right to my email. So feel free to write me there. And yeah, that's that.
Perfect. And you know, we'll have you on. We usually do these initial guest interviews, and we try to get a guest in. That way the audience gets to know who they are. And then we always invite everybody to come back. And if there's ever like an album release or something else, an event that goes on in your life, we always encourage and let our guests know. You're welcome to reach out to us, and we'll get you back on again for another promotional thing. But we really, like our first time getting guests on, we really just want the audience to get to know them and really organically know who they are, what they're about. And then that way, every time you come back on, they're more familiar. It's more personal for our audience. So it's been great having you on here. I look forward to getting you on again. And I'm encouraging the audience to go check out your webpage. I'm looking at it right now, lucascantormusic.com. And there's just a lot of good media on there to listen to and check out. And you can learn a lot about Lucas on here. So I encourage you guys to do that. Lucas, it's been great having you on here.
Thank you. I want to say one thing to the audience. If you want to support me, all you have to do is follow me on Instagram, because I'm in the midst of selling a book proposal. And they want to see that I have a social media presence. So I don't need your money. I don't need your Patreon. Just hit follow. That's it.
Boom. There it is, guys. So I encourage all of you to do that. Go over to his Instagram and check that out, and get him some follows going. Perfect.
Also, I post music. It's fun. You'll probably like it.
Hey, I know, and I take requests. Audience. There you go. And now that's original. That's original. Yep. I like that.
Yeah, DM me a request. I'll do it. I mean, you're going to get it on banjo, but I'll do it.
Hey, that's awesome. Yep. That's awesome. Lucas, it's been great having you on here, man. You have a great day.
Great. You too. Thank you.